Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Armchair Survivalist. My name is Kurt Wilson, and welcome to the show. Today is April the 25th in the year 2021. If you go to armchairsurvivalist.com and you scroll down, all the way down, you'll see all the different ways to listen to me. I'm on every podcast venue there is. You can listen to my chat room. You can download my shows from the archives. Okay, now, always remember, I'm a one-man band here, so if the show notes don't get put up on time, I do what I can because I got so much other stuff going on, it's ridiculous. Just to get some business out of the way for my company, Survival Enterprises, se1.us, survivalenterprises.com. We have the ham radios in still. We have the $50 ones, the $75 ones, and these are the handheld units. They're brand new. You guys are going to love these things. I've sold hundreds and hundreds of these. The Mountain House buckets are back in. We sold out. We got another pallet. These are the 5 days of food delivered anywhere in the United States, $150. Now, they're not on the website yet. So these things I'm telling you, like the ham radios, they're not on the websites yet. The food is not on the website yet because I haven't had time to put it up. So you have to call us, 310-295-9686. 310-295-9686. Now, those of you who listen to me on YouTube, please stop. If you can listen on YouTube, then you can listen on any of the other apps, or you can listen to my chat room, or you can download my show. YouTube is censoring me. Surprise, surprise. Probably because I used to brag how they haven't censored me yet. It's funny. I've got over 300 of my old shows on YouTube. So please stop using YouTube to listen to me yet. You know, when the communists grab hold of a concept, they go hog wild with it. And this thing that the communists always have done is censoring people. They've always shut down opposition one way or the other. If all you can hear are lies, well, then that's what you will believe. Well, maybe not you personally, but too many damn people. Now, I also have, if you go to armchairsurvivalist.com, on the right-hand side, you'll see some little banners, a little row of different things for sale. And the top of those banners is Pure VPN. This is virtual private network. If you want to go on the internet with nobody knowing who you are, okay, this is what you have to have. This gives you a level of protection that years ago we didn't even know existed. You just click on a banner. It's a very simple process. Do your due diligence. Look around. See which one you want. There's a monthly, yearly, 2 years, what have you. I checked all the other VPNs I could find out. And this one is the most stable. This one's the most stable. It has servers in hundreds of countries. It's like, oh, let's say I want to go and download a movie somewhere. Well, I go on my VPN, and now all of a sudden I'm in Germany. Or I'm in Italy. Depends on my mood. Or I could be in San Francisco. Or it could be in Washington, D.C. It all depends on how you check it. There's boxes you can check. There's different ways you can do it. It's idiot-proof, believe me. If I can do it, anybody can do it. All right, so now we're going to get into the economy. I don't have a lot of time to talk because I have a lot of stuff that you guys need to hear. So you know what Bitcoin is. My son is into a cryptocurrency. He's playing with it. He's enjoying himself with it. And Dimwit opened his mouth and mentioned that he wants to raise capital gain taxes up to 50-something percent. And because of that, Bitcoin lost over $260 billion value in 3 days. $260 billion. This is why I don't recommend putting a lot of money in a virtual bank like this, right? In Bitcoin, you can't pick it up. You can't pick it up. You can't even look at it. Well, you can look at it if you know how to read the back end. Anyway, you got to know what you're doing. You got to be willing to lose money. And you can become a millionaire overnight. This is the gamble with cryptocurrency. Some years back, one of my listeners went to Australia because he had purchased a lot of silver, 10,000 ounces, from the Perth Mint. And he had gone there and he discovered that the silver doesn't exist. They're selling ownership papers is basically it. So you, they say, yeah, we'll sell you an ounce of silver for, I don't know, $20. And we'll keep it here for you. So all you need is the paper, the certificate. and we mail that to you. And see, look, you hold that up and say, look, this is an ounce of silver. I can get it anytime I want. So for every ounce of silver, the Perth Mint has sold 1,000 ounces worth of that 1 ounce of silver. So there's 1,000 papers out there that say 1 ounce of silver to 1 ounce of actual silver that's in their mint. This is a massive scam. And it's happening all over the world. Any of these companies that sell precious minerals, and it could be gold, it could be copper, it could be silver, it doesn't matter what it is. Most of them claim, oh, don't worry about it. You don't need to take control of it. We'll save you the hassle and we'll store it here. If you don't have it in your hand, you don't have it, period. I got an article from the EU, and let me read what this website says. The European Medicines Agency publishes these data so that its stakeholders, including the general public, can access information that European regulatory authorities use to review the safety of a medicine or active substance. Transparency is a key guiding principle of the agency. Basically, what this is, agency is kind of like this American CDC, Center for Disease Control. And they have an area there. The CDC has the same area, except it's kind of hidden. You got to look for it. But in Europe, they want everybody to know what's been going on. So this COVID-19 vaccine, so far, 6,662 dead. This is from the vaccine, any of the vaccines. 299,065 injured. And this could be in the hospital permanently for the rest of their life. Stomachs dissolve, going blind, going deaf. And this is from Moderna, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, and Johnson & Johnson. 6,600 dead in the EU. Now, they're not even telling us any part of this here. The masks that everybody's using. Both Stanford University and the National Institute of Health have done massive, massive studies. And they realize that the masks, let's see, this is a quote from the Stanford University study. The masks are dirty, dehumanizing, and ineffective. The data suggests that both medical and non-medical face masks are ineffective to block human-to-human transmission of viral and infectious disease, such as, and then they name a bunch of viruses. So using a mask, and I don't care if it's one of these 10-cent paper ones or a cloth one, it doesn't matter. Trying to stop a virus with any kind of those masks is like trying to stop a mosquito using a chain-link fence, and that's exactly how bad it is. I almost cried 2 days ago. I went to Home Depot, and the clerk there was a kid that I knew, and he was probably about 24, 25, and I've talked to him many times, but he has to wear this mask. He has acne on his face so bad it looks like scar tissue, but where do you think he has it? From the tip of his nose down to the tip of his chin and from ear to ear, exactly where the mask is sitting. Now we're going to get into the liberal psychosis. You're going to love this one. This comes from the same county, Santa Clara County in California, where when I was a kid, I got the bubonic plague. Let me read you the first paragraph. Teachers in California, Santa Clara County were reportedly instructed last year to hide from students' parents their ethnic studies teaching materials, which described the United States as a settler colonist regime responsible for genocide and white supremacy. This is what's being taught in our schools. I am never so mad at people when they have kids from, 7 to 17 that are still in public schools. And then afterwards, the parents say, I don't know what went wrong. My daughter become a lesbian and my son is in jail for robbery and I don't know what's happening. I don't get it. What the hell is wrong with you people that have children? Get them out of the damn schools. This is ridiculous. This is, the propaganda is so bad. They're openly making commercials and shows that they only show your children in school. You won't see it on TV. You won't hear about it. They're not going to ask your damn permission. I got a clip it's a propaganda piece. The whole premise behind this propaganda piece is that they're pretending that the communists won in America and a utopian paradise was created because of the communist ideals and what they wanted to do. You got to, this is being played to your children. There are thousands of other ones just like this.
Looking back, it's hard to believe that we've rebuilt our community from the ground up with our own hands. The first seeds were planted way back in the terror and tenderness of the pandemic. And then change bloomed in the streets, in the fire and struggle of the uprisings. Around here, we'll never forget the day that the last prisoners were released, walking out into the arms of their loved ones. The easy part was finding work. The Community Care Corps was always looking for people in those days, whether for universal family care, burying border walls, or green new public housing, going up one pod at a time. Yep, it was a good time for busy hands.
Funny, thinking back to the first wave of the pandemic, that's what you really remember. Hands. Washing, scrubbing, disinfecting, washing again, picturing each other's hands. All the hands that had touched whatever we were touching. The hands that packed the box, that picked the tomato, that planted the seed. The hands that stroked the brow, that said goodbye. The hands were us, all of us. That web of hand-to-hand, breath-to-breath relationships was a reminder. We are all entangled, making each other sick, keeping each other alive. That was just one of the lessons of COVID-19. It started in the first great pause, when the smog cleared and the rich fled the cities. When poverty dropped its disguise and racist inequality drew the map of the disease. As the roar of the traffic faded, we arose to birdsong and ambulance sirens. The virus showed us what was truly essential. And we learned again and again that so many of us doing essential work were being treated as sacrificial. From nursing homes to detention facilities, meatpacking plants and fulfillment centers, the virus exposed the cruelty of these warehouses of efficiency and profit. Then, things got worse. In 2023, super droughts led to mega floods. Locusts carved a path across continents and hyper-typhoons drove millions from their homes. COVID-23 raced through storm shelters and refugee camps. Supplies ran out again. Meanwhile, dinosaurs roamed the halls of power, bellowing that more sacrifice was needed. But every time they cranked up that rusty old machine called economic growth, the cloud of sickness and death grew.
And we couldn't breathe. Couldn't breathe from the asthma in our polluted communities, from the smoke of those fires. We couldn't breathe with a knee on our necks. In the clouds of tear gas as we shouted, Black Lives Matter. And that is how the virus changed everything. We finally understood that we couldn't keep patching up the same broken systems. We had to build something new. What was needed was a spark. That spark was us. After months of organizing, the viral rent strike was like a starting gun. Then came the essential worker strike. Delivery drivers, street cleaners, and farm workers got together and said, enough! This time, people didn't just clap from their balconies. We flooded into the streets to join together. One of the leaders was Luciella, a young food courier. When a police bullet stole her life, the crowds exploded in size and then exploded again, spreading across borders like a countervirus. The sparks looked different in every country. As the wildfire strike swept across borders, economies ground to a halt, this time blockaded by workers. We lost too many young heroes as states brought out the iron fist, but it was no match for the raised fist of solidarity. Soon, authoritarian rulers started to topple like statues, and new governments were suddenly nervous about ignoring the streets. We joined hands and pushed further, launching the years of repair.
The first step was rebuilding the economy around the core of essential work. Food and farming, care for young and old, public health. not to mention the essential labor of the more than human world, the winged pollinators, the leafy oxygen makers. The Full Employment Act made the new priorities clear, and there was a wave of new worker cooperatives in everything from mental health support to public art and tree planting. Many bosses were made redundant. Our information ecology needed tending too. And so we built a digital commons, vaccinated it against surveillance, and built up our herd immunity to disinformation. Fossil fuels were running on fumes by that point, so we harnessed their final profits to clean up their messes. Whatever we could, we did outdoors. School, theatre, celebrating. At first, because it was safer. Then, because we realised it made us happier. Nobody talked about missing shopping. Anyway, the Right to Repair movement meant that a lot of stuff got fixed rather than thrown away and replaced. With life moving at a slower pace, we finally had time to look back, and we began the most important repair of all, repairing relationships. In colonial countries like the US, Canada, Australia, and the UK, those were hard conversations. But truth and reparations commissions helped some of us face the truth about the violent conquests of the past and how they shaped our world. That guided where we repaired and how. It turned out that once we fully funded schools and housing and healthcare, we didn't need those bloated budgets for policing, prisons, and war. And ultimately, the flow of money on planet Earth had to be reversed. So the North finally started paying its debts, and the South finally stopped.
Around here, the Land Back program began the historic process of returning some of the stolen land to Indigenous jurisdiction. In the process, we remembered how taking care of the Earth lays the ground for taking care of each other. Within just a few years, we could see the bottom of the river again, and it was safe to drink and fish in its waters. Things aren't perfect, of course. Between mutating viruses and our warming world, there's always new storms headed our way. But when they come, we're ready. With our networks of nurses and neighbors, our small farms and big forests, our systems of care and repair, no one is sacrificed.
Why don't you ask your children when they come home, what kind of movies did you guys watch today? Did you have somebody come in and show you a movie or talk to you about something that sounds anti-American? You'll find out. Now, we're under the liberal psychosis, and under the liberal psychosis, we have the Democrat perversion, because all things perverted stem from Democrats. There's this kid's cartoon. It's called Bluey. It looks like an Australian Shepherd. Okay, well, it's all dogs that's in it, right? It's all dogs. It's an award-winning, mega-hit animated series about the Healers, a family of dog-shaped humans. And again, it's supposed to be all dogs, okay? Except they're coming under fire now from the communists, because they don't have any queers and queer dogs in there. They don't have any all-black BLM dogs in there. They don't have any of the other lower forms of life in there. They're critiquing it and saying that they need to take it off the air because it's not as diverse as it should be. I'm kind of tongue-tied here because this just said to our enemies, we're a joke. We are a joke. The United States is a joke. The queers have their rainbow-colored flag. They call it a pride flag. It's the flag that all the various sexual perversions wave at. The U.S. embassies worldwide are going to be flying the pride flag just below the U.S. flag on the same pole. Nothing tells our enemies that we're weak better than flying a flag of something that is mentally disgusting and held as evil worldwide. Now we're getting into government threat. So last week, the House of Commies in D.C. decided that they want to make District of Columbia a 51st state. So they had it's called a heated debate. In other words, the Democrats have already decided that they want Washington, D.C. to be the 51st state. And if they did that, there'd never be another Republican in office anywhere, ever, especially presidency. And they had what's called a heated floor debate. Democrats don't give a damn. They just let the Republicans wear themselves out bitching. And then they went ahead and passed it. So the House passed D.C. statehood bill. It is very disgusting. District of Columbia, Washington, D.C., is not part of the United States. It never has been. I don't see it going anywhere because it can't be part of the United States. It has to be a foreign nation. That's why it's District of Columbia, not Washington. Washington is 15 miles west of me. Now, you have heard that all of this crap, this cancel culture, all of this stuff, all the snowflakes, the political hogwash is called woke. So it's these people are woke. They're woke. In other words, it's an acronym for waking up, realizing that life is more important if you're LGBT or anti-American or not white or, you know, everything that's evil, basically. Well, Dimwit has put this woman named Jessica Bongiorni. She's the chief officer of human capital at the Veterans Health Administration. She hates whites. She hates Americans. She hates veterans. And she teaches something called critical race theory. She brings people into the VA to give lectures to us idiot white people so we understand that we really are the form and source of all known racism. That's what critical race theory is. Critical race theory basically says that all whites are evil. They don't have souls. They are racist. Blacks cannot be racist because, well, they're not white. This is what it teaches. In all schools that they teach this, they teach children, if they're white, they're not worthy of anything. They're worthless creatures if they're white. This is critical race theory. And this female is bringing it to the VA. It is teaching all of the employees critical race theory. Let's see. She's talking in this one article to supervisors about the African American history and culture at the National Museum. It provides Americans with additional research resources to both reflect on their own history with race and lead conversation about race. Meanwhile, many of you are more than well-versed in these topics because you live them every day and don't need more education. Okay, here's the thing. Again, these people are teaching whites that they are bad and evil, and white is why blacks are held down. In other words, they're pretending that whites are why blacks are a victim mentality, not that the Democrats are doing it, but white people did. See, just because you're white doesn't mean you're bad, especially if you're a Democrat. If you're a Democrat, well, that's okay. You can be white because you're an ally of ours. And I know, well, you know, you had this George Floyd trial this week on the white guy that kneeled on him. So everyone's thinking, oh, what's going to be? Is he going to be guilty? Is he going to be innocent or what? Is he going to be freed? We don't know. But the blacks are out threatening. Not just the blacks, but those semi-humanoid white creatures that were out with him as well. And the rest of the communists. And they were threatening. If he's not found guilty, we're going to burn this city down. Maxine Waters, that's a black racist woman. She has a big mouth. And she gets out there. And she starts threatening whitey, starts threatening white people that they're going to get more confrontational. All of this is insane. And she gets away with this crap. Now, if it was a white guy that was doing this, oh, you'd bet your butt that he'd be in jail. But Maxine Waters was out there threatening and saying, we need to get more confrontational. A few hours later, there's National Guard out there, right? A few hours later, some of the National Guard were involved in a drive-by shooting. Yeah, they got more confrontational. I don't know if you heard about it or saw it on TV, but Dimwit went to a climate summit. When I say went to, I mean he sat down and had a camera on him, and they were doing a virtual meeting. The Ice Age Farmer has something to say about that.
World leaders convened at a virtual climate summit where Joe Biden announced new targets for United States in curbing our carbon emissions, among them limiting you to one burger per month. That's right, dropping red meat consumption by 90%. You're only allowed to eat 4 pounds per year of red meat. This also included forcing you to own an electric car from here on out, and of course installing a heat pump, getting rid of your fireplace or any other heating for your home. But not only that, John Kerry, the climate czar, has announced that it's not enough to stop carbon emissions, that in fact we need to get carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, perhaps using, as California is proposing, giant carbon sequestration vacuum cleaners. It seems there is no depth to the stupidity of this agenda, but in fact it's not dumb. It is a bid for total control over humanity and all activity on the planet.
You said twice getting to net zero is going to be hard, really hard. But even if we get to net zero, we still have to get carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So this is a bigger challenge than a lot of people have sort of really grabbed onto yet.
Yeah, he actually said that. We need to get carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Stunning hubris from these people. But California prepared to implement it nonetheless. From the LA Times, the clock is running out on climate change, and California says it's time for giant carbon vacuums. As an advisor to Jerry Brown said, if you want to keep global warming at bay, you can't do it simply by limiting emissions. You have to sequester significant amounts of carbon. And at this point, we really should be asking ourselves, why is Bill Gates blocking the sun and geoengineering, and why are they trying to remove all carbon dioxide from the atmosphere? What kind of planetary terraforming are they engaging in here? I don't have the answers to that. What I do know is that Joe Biden really did take to the stage today to unveil the new targets for the United States. Among them, as I mentioned, you'll be limited to now one burger a month, and that is in cutting our red meat consumption by 90% across the entire American population. Remember, these are federal goals. And even beyond red meat, all animal products, not just animal source food, all animal products by 50% by 2030. It also includes making the switch to electric cars. Quote, more than half of the new cars bought in the U.S. would need to be electric within the next decade in this decade of action. It would mean 65% of all new cars and SUVs and 10% of trucks would need to be electric. And we're running at about 2% right now. So you can imagine drastic top-down measures of control must be implemented to get that target hit. And then, of course, as we've mentioned at the UK level, now in the US, retrofitting homes to use electric heat pumps so that you are tied to the grid exclusively and depend on that as a source of heat to keep your family warm in the increasingly cool winters. Quote, nearly 25% of homes by 2030 would need to be heated by electricity rather than using natural gas or oil to reach these emissions goals. Nearly $6,000 electric heat pump. So each of the three mandates that Biden unveiled today come directly from these goals. They come directly from the prescribed agenda of the United Nations. We're not in charge of this country right now. Biden is just rolling through the agendas one by one. And I find it telling that in terms of trying to take control, they're happy to float absolute zero. How much freedom will you be allowed? Absolutely zero. How much choice will we will have as a consumer? Absolutely zero. But when it comes to keeping our children safe, how much arsenic or lead will they allow to be in baby food? That's called closer to zero. When it comes to safety, they really don't care about you. This is not about saving the earth. It's not about your safety. It's about taking total control. And it's for that reason that news outlets started issuing new editorial guidance, somehow all at the same time. Stop calling it global warming. We're going to rename it again. Now it's a climate emergency. A new deal, a green background on the new deal. So here's the Green New Deal. It's here. We're walking into it right now. And here's another aspect of that. From Meat and Poultry Magazine, Meat Industry Report, Getting Smart on Food Waste. Report describes that we can now start to look at using active packaging, which interacts with its environment to help the food keep longer. Well, that sounds kind of cool. But they also mention intelligent packaging, which actually is smart packaging for food. It's in communication with the world outside the package, perhaps giving consumers information on temperature, freshness, or any potential exposure the food has had to microbes. It can be used to provide a link to automation using barcodes, QR codes, or even augmented reality to enhance the consumer experience. It's being created in the name of reducing food waste, but what's actually happening is, much like we've seen the beginnings of the supply chain being grafted into this AI blockchain-based virtual reality complete awareness of all resources on the planet, now we want to extend that through to the consumer into your home. We want your Samsung fridge to talk to your meat packaging and find out how long it's been in there, what the temperature was, and how much you've eaten in it. And if you're not eating everything you bring home from the supermarket, you better bet your smart fridge and your smart packaging is going to tell on you. and your social credit score will suffer. Just like the recycling bins in China that use AI and facial recognition to demerit your social credit score if you're too wasteful with your food. Now, this is going global via smart packaging, intelligent packaging, as they called it. Quote, given consumers' current concerns about food safety because of the pandemic, on-package indicators of exposures to microbes are certainly in demand. So again, we're going to play on your fears. We're going to say, due to COVID, we've got to have smart packaging that tells us how much you eat, and we'll just roll it out. There is the appeal to blockchain. Also discussed was blockchain as a method of monitoring food waste. And while it's not the only way to monitor waste, it's the most secure. It's for your safety. However, the industry has been slow to adopt that trend, but you can expect that to change during this decade of action leading up to 2030. Here's a couple other indicators of how quickly this absolute zero cutting emissions and taking total control over humanity is rolling forward. French lawmakers have approved a ban on short domestic flights. Because remember, flying, no, is a big red circle there. By 2050, there will be no flight. And by 2030, most airports will close. It's only the major hubs, international connections, they're going to be open. Beyond that, it's all rail. That's why Biden is also investing into Amtrak. It's also why French mayor was telling his citizens, you probably don't want to try and be a pilot. That's not really a job that's going to exist in the future. Probably time for you to give up on your dreams of being in aviation, because he knows that that's being cut out. That's part of the plan. It's right there on the absolute zero agenda, which is public for us all to see that this is going on. Another one rolling forward in Amsterdam. They're now considering a ban on open fireplaces and wood-burning stoves. Now, this has already happened in most of the Bay Area, across San Francisco and around the surrounding area, in the name of keeping the air clean. But of course, again, this ties into forcing everyone onto electric heat pumps, which they control. Another one, New Zealand, to phase out livestock exports. You saw the beginnings of this when that ship went down and took hundreds of cattle with it and killed them. But now, indeed, they are extending what was initially a temporary ban on shipping livestock by boat to a permanent one. We're never going to do it again. We had one boat go down. Again, after all, it says shipping must decline to zero by 2050. So this is the beginning of that. We're going to stop shipping our animals that way. We're going to move to a new direction. Plus, animal agriculture is on the way out anyway, right? We've seen that plenty. Again, back to California. Oakland is going to start enforcing the ban on gas-powered leaf blowers. So we've talked about this. Anything that's not even talking about cars, but any of your leaf blowers, lawnmowers, chainsaws, anything that takes gas is now banned across California. And while most places aren't bothering to enforce that by any stretch of the imagination, Oakland now is the first place that's actually trying to make that literally something that you can be punished for. A new ordinance, string trimmers, leaf blowers, lawnmowers, etc. Please switch to electric utilities, is their point. Rhode Island is ready to hop on the same bandwagon. Governor McKee there is about to sign a bill to get Rhode Island to net zero carbon emissions by when? Why? By 2050, of course, aligning exactly with this agenda.
So this category is government threat. And we, the world, faces no greater threat than from a communist insane leader. And that's what dimwit is. Because I get briefings from the Department of Homeland Security, I was given a link to Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. He is the communist that's in charge of Department of Homeland Security. And this guy is just another one of the wacko creatures that dimwit and the rest of the communists put in charge of us.
It is a pleasure to speak with all of you today as we explore innovative ways we can adapt to the realities of the climate emergency. As a Secretary of Homeland Security, I am deeply aware of the impacts this issue has on both our national security and our collective global security. At the Department, we must and we will do more to address the climate crisis. Under President Biden's leadership, we will implement a new approach to climate change, adaptation, and resilience, and we will do so with the sense of urgency this problem demands. Further, we know that the negative effects of climate change on people around the world, including vulnerable populations, creates additional migrant and refugee populations. It is vital, then, that we act to reduce emissions and to promote resilience and adaptation, both as a department and with our partners. Which is why I am excited to announce a series of new actions today. First, I have launched a Department of Homeland Security Climate Change Action Group, a coordinating body at the highest leadership level. The Climate Change Action Group will include every senior leader from across the department and report directly to me in order to drive urgent action to address the climate crisis. The scale of the emergency is only growing. This body will refocus and elevate our efforts. Second, today, the department published an important and ambitious request for information from the American people, focusing specifically on how the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, as it is commonly known, can ensure that its programs advance equity for all and increase resilience, especially among those who are disproportionately at risk from climate change impacts. The public information we receive will help FEMA to perform its time-honored mission of helping people before, during, and after disasters under modern conditions. In the coming years, we will reorient FEMA so that it achieves its long-standing goal of building a culture of preparedness in the context of novel risks, above all those produced by climate change. Finally, we are finding new opportunities across the department to promote environmental sustainability. For example, DHS, our department, is leading the way in the adoption of electric vehicles with the goal of electrifying 50% of our fleet by 2030. I have said before that the Department of Homeland Security is a department of partnership. In tackling the enormous challenges presented by climate change, our partnerships will be the key to success. For too many years, too little has been done. Now is the time for action. I welcome this panel's ideas for how we can support each other and work together to reduce emissions, to create jobs, to help the most vulnerable among us, and to ensure that our nation and the world are prepared to build stronger and more resilient communities.
What the hell does the Department of Homeland Security have to do with climate change and all of the crap that he just spouted? And speaking of the puppet... So I'm going to read you this article. The Biden administration on Friday announced that it was ending a federal ban on funding research that uses tissue from aborted children. An announcement from the National Institutes of Health said that the Human Fetal Tissue Research Ethics Advisory Board, created by the Trump administration to review funding proposals that wanted to use tissue from aborted babies, would no longer be convened. So in other words, Dimwit eradicated the concept of ethics when it comes to aborted babies. The board had reviewed 14 proposals and rejected 13 of them. So basically what he did was he said, okay, now you can go ahead and actually start selling and using parts of aborted babies. Do you know it's an actual federal felony to sell body parts from abortions? It's a federal felony. But if it was a Republican doing it, it'd be different. But it's not. It's a communist doing it. Something else Dimwit's administration's doing. You know all of these criminal aliens? These minors, they call them? That's somebody under the age of 26. Most gang members are between the age of 13 and 17. Biden is sending them, dumping them, putting them on buses, putting them on planes, and sending them all over the United States. A lot of times, not even talking to the mayors, where they're dumping these people. Now, I mentioned how Bitcoin lost $260 billion in a few days. Yeah, this is because Biden needs some way to pay for all of this communist utopian crap that he wants to create. So he's looking at raising taxes on, and I quote, the rich, anywhere from 36 to 53%. So the money you earn, they want to take from you. what I'm finding disgusting is that the House, because it's fully Democrat-controlled, is passing gun control regulation. Just passing it, passing it, passing it, passing it. They don't need Republicans. They don't need to. They don't need any Republicans. They want to pass, they want to make all silencers illegal. They want to make, not, when I say illegal, that means you can't own them. All machine guns illegal, that means you can't own them. All assault weapons illegal, whatever the hell those are. They want you to get a license to buy ammunition. They want you to get a license to travel from state to state with firearms. And I actually, this is the funny thing. I actually had one of these communists come in here and she was telling me, she goes, "You guys are crazy. We don't want your guns. We don't want your guns. Democrats have never wanted your guns."
Today's top story, President Biden, who's surrounded by Secret Service members with guns to protect him and who also controls a military heavily armed with guns, wants to take your guns. Because guns are bad. Why is this a good thing? Stay tuned to find out. It's kind of like rules for thee, but not for me. Know what I mean? President Biden has signed 6 executive orders on gun control. This comes after the mass shooting in Colorado. The Biden administration, instead of shamelessly offering their condolences to the victims and their families, sees the tragedy as an opportunity to further their political agenda of gun control. And they did so with such blinding speed that it's almost as if they had everything in place and were just waiting for the right tragedy to take advantage of, which shows how much they care. Some people are opposed to the Biden administration implementing stricter gun control laws, believing that authoritative powers with guns trying to take your guns is one of the reasons why you need guns. But not if the powers that have guns that are taking your guns are doing so for your protection. Some people can be so short-sighted. Some also believe that gun control laws won't deter criminals, because criminals, by definition, don't obey laws. These naysayers state things like, "If Hunter can't follow gun laws, then why would any other criminal?" The Second Amendment states that a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. But the plot thickens, because in speaking of the Second Amendment recently, President Biden said, "No amendment is absolute." This is heartwarming news, because most freedom-loving people feel safer when their constitutional rights are infringed on. And of course, the Second Amendment is not absolute, because if you read the fine print, you'll see it applies to a free state. In the left's completely ideal gun control agenda, which again, is for your protection, President Biden has signed 6 executive orders on gun control, one of which is the Model Red Flag Law. This executive order allows police and the courts to strip a person of their firearms without evidence or probable cause, and requires the person prove their innocence in order to get them back. That's a big one. I really can't stress that one enough. And it's for your protection. On the matter, Tim Kennedy, a Green Beret and Special Forces sniper, took to Instagram to share a history lesson on what happens when governments take weapons from the people. Along the way, he pointed out that the power shifts from the people, where it's supposed to be, to the government, where it's not supposed to be. In the video, Tim Kennedy shared examples throughout history to back up his point. For example, in 1911, Turkey established gun control, and from 1915 to 1917, 1.5 million Armenians were murdered. In 1929, the Soviet Union established gun control, and from 1929 to 1953, 20 million dissidents were killed. In 1935, China established gun control, and from 1948 to 1952, 20 million citizens were systematically killed. This just in! China also currently has an active genocide happening against its unarmed citizens. In 1938, Germany established gun control, and from 1939 to 1945, they killed 13 million Jews and other Europeans. Furthermore, history also has it that Guatemala established gun control in 1964, And from 1964 to 1981, 100,000 Mayan Indians were rounded up and killed. Uganda established gun control in 1970. And from 1971 to 1979, 300,000 Christians, unable to defend themselves, were killed. Cambodia established gun control in 1956, and from 1975 to 1977, 1 million people were exterminated. In Rwanda, strict gun control laws went into effect in 1979, and in 1994, 800,000 people were killed in just 100 days. And by the way, they used propaganda from mainstream media outlets to fuel and justify the genocide. Luckily, on Tim Kennedy's post, who has risked his life on many occasions and seen many of his friends die in combat in order to protect the American people, had his post labeled partly false by independent fact checkers. Because luckily, the fact checkers came out to protect the American people from Tim Kennedy protecting them. When clicking for more information, you learn there is no direct link between gun control and authoritarian regimes. Of course there's no direct link, aside from the previous examples of Turkey, the Soviet Union, China, Germany, Guatemala, Uganda, Cambodia, and Rwanda. But also, not even those. With more bravery than Tim Kennedy, the independent fact-checkers are protecting the American people from history when they say there is no direct link between gun control and authoritarian regimes. And these are independent fact-checkers, so you have nothing to worry about. Common wisdom has it that if you don't learn from history, it'll repeat itself. But even better, now we're learning from fact-checkers that history hasn't happened. And it's really hard for history to repeat itself if it hasn't even happened yet. In fact, you can learn more about these independent fact-checkers when you click Learn More, which I did. Reducing the spread of false information on Instagram. Who doesn't love the thought police? Then you see these third-party fact-checkers are certified through the nonpartisan International Fact-Checking Network. Well, I wanted to learn more, so I clicked on that. Now you're on Poynter.com, the International Fact-Checking Network's website. Then, just for fun, I typed in major funders in their search function, and a page called Major Funders came up on their site. So I clicked on that. And that reveals a list of the largest funders of Poynter, who again are the ones certifying independent fact-checkers who fact-checked Tim Kennedy on Instagram and everyone else all over social media. And I, for one, was curious who the largest funders of the International Fact-Checking Network are. So I scrolled down a little bit, and I saw Facebook. Facebook owns Instagram, and Instagram's independent fact-checkers are certified through an organization that Facebook funds. And they're the ones that labeled Tim Kennedy's post partly false, saying there's no direct link between gun control and authoritarian regimes. Now, that might make you start to think that if an authoritarian regime was trying to confiscate everyone's weapons so they could more easily take out anybody that opposes them, as history shows happens, then they could be trying to control free speech through their partnership with big tech with all their censorship and fact-checking. And then it could look like they're using their control of free speech to monopolize everyone's attention onto their propaganda about how giving up gun rights protects everyone. And then it would look like their ability to disarm the population would be much easier. But if it seems that way to you, you are wrong. Because these are independent fact-checkers, which makes this whole scheme impossible. It says right here, independent. Now, that's not a word worth looking into like I did. So odds are this whole scenario isn't happening. The fact-checkers are here for your protection. And Biden wants to take your guns for your protection. And I'm controlling how you think about this for your protection. The great comedian Dave Chappelle once said, "The First Amendment is first for a reason. The Second Amendment is just in case the first one doesn't work out." Well, Dave, the first one isn't working out so well. But luckily, now we're taking away the second. So with our full report tonight, now your brain can conclude it's good to have your gun rights taken away because it's for your protection. That's it for tonight. Tune in tomorrow for our full report on how volunteering for an upcoming genocide will protect you and your family.
Now, I want to play you another one of these child's propaganda pieces. And if you notice in this one how cleverly they use the exact right buttons for children who... Now, why would a child care about this subject that they're going to talk about? Well, they don't. But then they're going to go to their parents and say, what is that? Why don't we get rid of this? Let's get rid of this. It said it on Sesame Street. It said it on elsewhere. You know, this is the kind of thing that they are going for. They go for the children's minds first, and that's where they grab them. They convince the children that acting in an American constitutional way is racist. And they're not teaching black children this. They're teaching white children this. Because, see, black children already know that whites are racist. That's their parents teach them that.
It's time for another episode of
That's Racist!
Today we want to talk about the Philo-Doe Buster Keaton, the Feeling Busted, the Fulobuster, the Filibuster, and why it's super racist. The Philo-Doe Buster Keaton, sorry, filibuster, is a procedural loophole that allows a minority of senators to block hugely popular bills from ever coming to a vote. Now, you may be asking, why is that racist? Well, what has the filibuster been used for? The filibuster has been used to prevent 200 anti-lynching bills from passing. Say it with me, kids.
That's racist!
It was first invented by pro-slavery senators before the Civil War.
That's racist!
Multiple civil rights bills, including the Civil Rights Act of 1964, were held up for months or stopped entirely by the filibuster.
That's racist!
In fact, until 1964, not a single substantial civil rights bill became law, all because of the filibuster. Today, we're fighting to pass voting rights and bills that protect democracy, like the For the People Act. What's standing in the way? The filibuster. The filibuster has been used time and time again to stop laws that would protect black lives and black rights. One last time, kids.
That's racist!
Black lives matter, so we need to end the Jim Crow filibuster and protect black lives. The filibuster is full on busted.
All right, now we're in a new category. We're under what I call commie racism. And maybe I'll get another name for it, because all the racists seem to be black. Like a BLM activist. This guy is one of the guys that hates whites. He's openly racist. He got arrested for attacking Asian women twice. Yet the media keeps spouting this crap that it's white supremacy that's causing this. There's not been any verified attacks by white people on Asians, period. They've all been blacks, all of them. Every single article. If you can find an article that shows a white guy attacked an Asian for no reason other than it's an Asian, please let me know. There was this thing that blacks play. It's called the knockout game. It's where they walk past a white person and then spin around and try and knock him out with one punch to the head. This is real. This is a real game, and it's on the rise all throughout the United States. I'm telling you right now, you see a bunch of black people standing on a corner, go to another corner. Don't walk around where blacks are, especially between the age of 13 and 30. There were two people that I know of in Boise that were done, this was done to. Now, the two didn't get knocked out, and the two black guys that did it got the hell beat out of them because other people saw. You pull that crap up here. People see it. They're coming after you. They don't need to be a participant in it. They see you. That makes them a participant, and they're coming after you. Arizona State University insists students of color shouldn't have to be able to write in order to get good grades. Grading students' work is a form of white supremacy that must be abolished. Must be abolished in order for black students to achieve at the same level as white students. Now, this is what gets me. These people are so insane. Students to achieve at the same level as white students. So in order to achieve, you actually have to perform a task and master it or pass a specific level of capability. White people can do it. Why can't the black people do it? Well, because they're victims. I got a couple minute clip here. These are racist things that I found in the past week that blacks have said. There are hundreds more. But this is the attitude that we're going to be fighting, and I mean in the streets.
All white people are racist. So I really want any white person in the room to know up front that this is what we're dealing with, that it's not going to be this coddling of white tears and what that looks like. We're not going to discuss, oh, maybe some of us have worked it out. No, you're always going to be racist, actually. So even when you're on your path to trying to figure out how to be a better human being, because I believe that white people are born into not being human, like that actually, instead of people felt color and black folks being dehumanized, that actually everyone is dehumanized off rip within white supremacy, that y'all are born into a life to not be human, and that's what y'all are taught to do, to be demons.
I'm Ami Horowitz. I'm back in Minneapolis, and the tensions are high. The city is about to explode. I'm here to find out what the hell is going on.
You can burn the whole city down. What does it matter?
Do you think the city's going to burn down?
Yes, absolutely.
By burning all the city down, we'll teach them a lesson?
I think, honestly, I'm all for burning it down. There shouldn't even be a trial. He should be convicted just as is.
If he got off, would you support street justice on him?
Y'all should have fed him to the wolves a long time ago.
How many unarmed black people were killed by cops last year? You have an idea?
100 plus? In just Minnesota?
No, around the country.
Oh, thousands.
Unarmed black people.
Thousands.
It seems like they're trying to erase, destruct the whole race of, you know, the African-American race.
Would you consider this a genocide? It's the eradication of an entire people.
That's a good question, and now that I've been confronted with it, I'm going to go ahead and say it.
I mean, genocide means, like, the targeting of one race for its destruction. Do you think that's what they're doing?
Genocide of anybody that's not white.
Would you call what's happening a genocide?
Yeah, I think that's one word for it.
Genocide?
Yes, most definitely.
A genocide?
Yeah.
Another civil war in this country in order for us to have true justice.
If that's what it takes, then we have to do it.
Do we need another civil war now?
If that's what it takes, then I believe so. If that's what it's going to take to revamp everything, for everything to be equal, at least equal, for us to have justice, I believe so.
Will it happen? Probably.
What percent of this country are white supremacists?
Say most of the country. I can't give you a number, but like...
You say majority of the country.
Yeah.
Should we just gather up the white supremacists and do street justice?
That would be ideal. Again, I'm not going to say anything that would directly incriminate me, but I would say that would be a good idea.
I don't want to say we need to go start killing all white folks, but it's like...
But...
Maybe.
What should protesters do?
Well, we got to stay on the street, and we've got to get more active. We've got to get more confrontational. We've got to make sure that they know that we mean business.
I want to start by playing a soundbite from this leaked audio tape, a conversation between Paul Rossi and George Davison, who's the head of school.
Okay, so we're demonizing white kids. Why don't you just say it?
We are using language that makes them feel less than for nothing that they are personally responsible for.
Okay, I'm going to tell you again, if you're a parent and you have a child in a public school system, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. Your child is being taught to hate himself. If you're white, your child is being taught to hate himself and to hate you and to hate America. This is what they're being taught. This is not what they used to be taught. All the black friends that I had when I was going up through middle school and high school, oh, every single one of them worked their butts off just like I did. It doesn't matter what color you are. You got to work your butt off to get anywhere in life. This is the anniversary of the Armenian genocide. We had friends when I grew up that were Armenian, and they would tell me stories. And I did a show some years back, and this clip that I'm going to play you is a culmination of that show. And I can tell you this, the first thing that happened was a group of people were attacked verbally. And everyone around was told how bad they were, how evil they were, how all of the ills of the population were their fault. And then the genocide started. On April 24th, it was an anniversary of the first genocide in the 20th century. Now, genocides have been performed by basically two groups on Earth. One are Muslims and the other are communists. The first genocide in the 20th century was done by Muslims in Turkey against the Armenians. Muslims worldwide, especially in Turkey, still say that this never occurred and it's just is propaganda by the West and it wasn't as bad as it seemed. They have all these different excuses. But I want to read you the actual history of this. The Armenian Genocide is what it was called, was a systematic killing and deportation of Armenians by the Turks of the Ottoman Empire. In 1915, during World War I, leaders of the Turkish government set in motion a plan to expel and massacre Armenians. Armenians have lived in the area of Turkey for 5,000 years or longer, and they are Christian. Armenians are all Christians. By the early 20s, when the massacres and deportations finally ended, about 1.5 million, and they actually say up to 3 million, Armenians were dead, with many more forcibly removed from the country. Today, most historians call this event a genocide. However, the Turkish government still doesn't acknowledge the scope of these events. The roots of the genocide, the Ottoman Empire, the Armenian people have made their home in the Caucasus region of Eurasia for 3,000 plus years. For some of that time, the Kingdom of Armenia was an independent entity. At the beginning of the 4th century, it became the first nation in the world to make Christianity its official religion. Now, from that point on, they were pretty much controlled by Muslims. Finally, it was the Ottoman Empire that ended up controlling them. The Ottoman rulers, they were all Muslims. They permitted religious minorities like the Armenians to maintain some autonomy, but they also subjected them to unequal and unjust treatment. They were considered infidels. Infidels is an animal with no soul. So the Christians had to pay higher taxes, and they had very few political or legal rights. Now, in spite of these obstacles, the Armenian community thrived under the Ottoman rule. They tended to be better educated and wealthier than their Turkish neighbors. Muslims are generally fairly ignorant, and I mean this generally. Out of 10 Muslims, you might have one or two that's actually gone to college, much less graduated high school. The resentment was compounded by suspicions that the Christian Armenians would be more loyal to Christian governments, that of the Russians, for example, than they were to the Ottoman Caliphate. These suspicions grew more acute as the Ottoman Empire crumbled. At the end of the 19th century, the despotic Turkish Sultan Abdulhamid II, obsessed with loyalty above all and infuriated by the Armenian campaign to win basic civil rights, declared that he would solve the Armenian question once and for all. Now, this was in 1890, not 1915. But this is the beginning of it. This would be what's called the First Armenian Massacre between 1894 and 1896. In response to large-scale protests by Armenians, Turkish military officials, soldiers, and ordinary men sacked Armenian villages and cities and massacred their citizens. Hundreds of thousands of Armenians were murdered. I have a story that I will be posting on my page for this date. In it is some information, first-hand information. I'll have all of this posted so you guys can look at it yourself. And this shows you what Muslims do. This is not what they can do. This is what they do. Muslims have been murdering and killing Christians now, well, for 1,400 years, but thousands and thousands are dying every year in the Middle East. Well, let me continue. In 1914, the Turks entered World War I on the side of Germany and the Nazis. And at the same time, the Muslims in Turkey, the Ottoman, declared a holy war against all Christians, unless you were an ally of them. Military leaders began to argue that the Armenians were traitors. If they thought they could win independence, if the Allies were victorious, this argument went, the Armenians would be eager to fight for the enemy. Then the Turkish government finally decided to push for removal of the Armenians from all along the war zone in Turkey. The genocide started April 24th, 1915. The Turkish government arrested and executed several hundred Armenian intellectuals. They just arrested and executed them. Sometimes they didn't even take them out of their house. They just put a bullet in their head when they answered the door. After that, our ordinary Armenians were turned out of their homes and sent on death marches through the Mesopotamian desert without food or water. It's a lot of stories from that. Frequently, the marchers were stripped naked and forced to walk under the scorching sun until they dropped dead. People who stopped to rest were shot. At the same time, these young Turks, they were called, created a special organization which in turn organized killing squads or butcher battalions to carry out, as one officer put it, the liquidation of the Christian elements. These killing squads were often made up of murderers and other ex-convicts. They drowned people in rivers, threw them off cliffs, crucified them, burned them alive. In short order, the Turkish countryside was littered with Armenian corpses. There is more to this, and I'm not going to read it all, but there is more to this. President Trump, as far as I know, the first U.S. president to actually acknowledge this was genocide, issued a statement on Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day, April 24th. I'm going to read that to you. Today we join the global community in memorializing the lives lost during the Meds Yaghan, one of the worst mass atrocities of the 20th century. Beginning in 1915, 1.5 million Armenians were deported, massacred, or marched to their deaths in the final years of the Ottoman Empire. On this day of remembrance, we pay respect to those who suffered and lost their lives, while also renewing our commitment to fostering a more humane and peaceful world. Every year on April 24th, we reflect on the strong and enduring ties between the American and Armenian people. We're proud of the founders of the American Committee for Armenian and Syrian Relief, a groundbreaking effort established in 1915 that provided crucial humanitarian support to Armenian refugees, and grateful for the thousands of Americans who contributed or volunteered to help Armenians expelled from their homes. On this day, we bear witness to the strength and resiliency of the Armenian people in the face of tragedy. We are fortunate that so many Armenians have brought their rich culture to our shores and contributed so much to our country, including decorated soldiers, celebrated entertainers, renowned architects, and successful business people. We welcome efforts by the Armenians and Turks to acknowledge and reckon with their painful history. On this day, we believe it is our obligation to remember those who suffered and perished, and reaffirm our commitment to protecting vulnerable religious and ethnic minorities around the world. And right now, religious minority around the world is Christianity. It's being attacked by the evil that crawls this planet: communism, Muslims, and Democrats. But right now, I have a clip I want to play that gives you a lot more information about this.
Let me stress that the Turkish people firmly believe that what happened to the Armenians was not genocide.
For 9 decades, they denied this ever happened. It's such an anachronism. It's shocking.
We have no reluctance to recognize genocide in Darfur. We have no reluctance to talk about the Cambodian genocide or the Rwandan genocide or the Holocaust. Why is it only this genocide?
It is incredible that Orhan Pamuk now faces 3 years in prison for what? For daring to even say that this should be discussed in Turkey today.
They are in denial. They're covering their tracks. They mocked the dead.
It's the last major taboo in Turkish politics. The authorities are afraid their own people will find out what happened.
Our society, our culture, we do not commit genocide. We will never accept an accusation like that.
But for those of you who aren't aware, there was a genocide that did take place against the Armenian people.
Overseas tonight, a critical American ally is up in arms, quite literally, about something that happened yesterday on Capitol Hill.
I see a hypocrisy in not recognizing the Armenian genocide simply because there is, quote unquote, an ally who doesn't want us to do so.
Now, the White House is warning that Turkey's reaction to what happened in Congress could further destabilize Iraq.
Journalist Harant Dink, one of the most prominent voices of Turkey's Armenian community, was killed by a gunman at the entrance to his newspaper's offices.
On January the 19th, 2007, Harant Dink, a Turkish Armenian journalist, was gunned down in broad daylight on the streets of Istanbul. His killer, a 17-year-old Turk. The reason? According to the gunman, Harant Dink had insulted the honor of the Turkish people. To this day, no sentence has ever been passed.
In the past few years, cracks have begun to appear in the wall of silence. Pandora's box had been opened in Turkey. Harant Dink stood up and said, "Yes, this was genocide."
For over 95 years, Turkey has denied that any genocide ever took place. Even today, just to mention it is an offense, for which Dink and many others had been prosecuted many times. But all he wanted was for the Turkish people to face up to their past, to the genocide of over 1 million Armenians, yet a crime which most ordinary Turks know little about.
He would say, "Don't think that they know and they're denying the facts. They're denying something they don't know." So it was about telling what happened. He would say, "I don't just want those responsible to say that they admit it, but I want the entire population to know that who did it. And I want to know that it will not happen again."
Although since Dink's murder, more and more people are starting to question it, the official version of Turkish history is simple. There was no genocide. Even today, it is widely accepted as the truth. Harant Dink had been fighting a century of official denial.
When you say genocide, that's the greatest accusation you could make against a nation. We, the Turkish people, will never accept this. From our point of view, our past is as clean as can be. No one should think we are capable of something like that.
An opinion shared by many Turks throughout Europe. although in recent years, many European parliaments, such as France, Switzerland, and Sweden, have acknowledged the genocide against Armenians. Many Turks feel personally insulted by this, as in Germany, they demonstrate against any attempt to recognize the atrocities for what they were, declaring the subject taboo. But the voices of those who demand Turkey face up to its past can no longer be ignored.
This process is certainly going to affect Turkey. Turkey will have to radically change its version of history. I want them to know. I want this to be discussed on every Turkish TV channel, in every newspaper, everywhere. Then Turkey will eventually have to admit, yes, it was genocide after all. We acknowledge that fact.
But for now, the Turkish government is unyielding. A key trading partner and the country that provides a bridge to the Middle East, it is too strategically important to risk upsetting, and forcing them to acknowledge an event that happened a century ago is not a priority for the leaders of Western nations. Turkey is a key NATO ally.
Although when the situation is about an alliance as important as NATO, which we claim is an alliance based on shared values, then we cannot keep silent about the truth. Too little is being done. Too little is being said plainly. People keep quiet about what they know to be true, because basically there is no one in Western Europe who doesn't know that it was a genocide.
As Turkey has come under pressure to recognize the genocide, its leaders have used their country's strategic importance to deflect all discussions, threatening to break off diplomatic relations and to cancel arms contracts. Each time the West caves in, and meantime all the Armenian victims and their descendants can do is wait in vain for official acknowledgement of the truth.
You tell your story, and you're told not only by the Turkish government or by Turkish citizens, but also by the American government and other Western governments, that what you lived through didn't really happen quite that way. Imagine what that would feel like. You survive and you live with those memories. You tell your truth, a truth you were told you would never get to tell, and then you're told that your truth is inadequate or is subjective or is overly emotional and is inaccurate. I think it's devastating.
Each year, on the 24th of April, hundreds of thousands of Armenians from all over the world make a pilgrimage to Yerevan, the capital of Armenia. Here, they mourn the victims at a monument standing not far from the country where their ancestors were citizens and the mass murder took place, Turkey. For it was there on the 24th of April 1915 that the annihilation of their people began. Armenians, the world's oldest Christians, call this genocide Ahet, literally the catastrophe.
It is time for people to finally accept the truth, and they have to stand up and do something about it to make sure that Turkey accepts it too. It's a sad feeling. It feels as if someone in your own family died. All those memories, the photos you see of people hung, the women, the children. The genocide must finally be acknowledged.
For the 3 million Armenians in the tiny Republic of Armenia, along with the 5 million scattered all over the world, the grief on this day is mixed with pain and anger. They cannot understand why even today Turkey will not acknowledge what happened back then. They feel betrayed and abandoned by a world that still accepts the Turkish version of history.
People talk about slaughtered Christians, slaughtered Armenians. On what basis are they making these ugly claims? To accuse Turkey without proof that such a massacre took place in 1915, to make such ugly claims against Turkey is absolutely unacceptable. No matter how often it is claimed, we will never accept it, because it never happened. But let them come and present their evidence. Then we will deal with our history if necessary.
Deep within the archives of the Ministry for Foreign Affairs in Berlin lie stored thousands of reports, letters, and notes, once classified papers written and compiled by Turkey's ally, the German Empire. Withheld for decades to protect Turkey, these documents leave no doubt about what really happened. There are reports from American and German diplomats, eyewitness accounts by Swiss, Danish, and Swedish doctors, missionaries, teachers, nurses, and journalists who lived in Turkey at the beginning of the last century and recorded what they saw. Notes on paper, long since yellowed with age, their authors dead for decades. Now, 95 years after the event, their testimony will be heard once more. Actors will lend their voices to those witnesses, for the first time, letting them speak again.
I had the honor to report to the embassy about one of the most severest measures ever taken by any government, and one of the greatest tragedies in all history.
These people were torn from their homes almost without warning and started toward the desert. Thousands of children and women, as well as men, died on these forced journeys, not only from hunger and exposure, but also from the inhuman cruelty of their guard.
Can you understand what it means to see all that and not be able to do a thing and have to stay alive yourself?
They died of starvation by the hundreds. Hearts succumbed to typhoid fever by the thousands. Homeless and orphaned children wandered aimlessly everywhere.
Long ignored eyewitness accounts can also be found at diplomatic and military archives in America, France, Denmark, Sweden, and Armenia. Like the reports compiled in Berlin, they too describe the genocide of the Armenians down to the last detail as a road of horrors. These records document the chronology of a crime so great that it is almost beyond human comprehension.
It has been no secret that the plan was to destroy the Armenian race as a race, but the methods have been more cold-blooded and barbarous, if not more effective, than I'd first supposed. There were dead bodies in all directions and on every road. The whole country was one vast charnel house, more correctly speaking, slaughterhouse. When one sees men and women 70 or even 80 years old, lame, blind, and sick, innocent women and children, and helpless babies sent away to be killed or die, and actually sees them dead or dying all around, it is impossible to conceive of any justification that can be urged for a measure so severe.
You cannot accuse the Turkish people as a whole of killing off the Armenians. They didn't want these atrocities, tolerated them, but seldom approved of them. The official reports from German consuls in Asia Minor bear witness to that. According to the reports, quite a number of Turkish officials in the provinces refused to carry out orders from their superiors in the capital.
During the 16th century, Constantinople was the capital of the vast Muslim Ottoman Empire, which spanned several continents. The world's oldest Christians, the Armenian people, had over time been split between three great empires: Persia, Russia, and the Ottoman Empire, where Armenians lived in six provinces in East Anatolia. By the beginning of the 20th century, 2 million Armenians live in Turkey. In a Muslim society, Christians are permitted a degree of religious and cultural freedom, but they are also required to pay special taxes and are routinely discriminated against. Despite being granted limited autonomy, they do not have the same rights as Muslims and are treated as second-class citizens. The Armenians complain about their lowly status and in vain demand political and social equality. Although many are tradesmen, farmers, and craftsmen in the towns, a prosperous Armenian middle class emerges.
Some of these people were from wealthy and refined circles. Some were accustomed to luxury and ease. There were clergymen, merchants, bankers, lawyers, mechanics, tailors, and men from every walk of life.
But despite repeated promises of equality, over the years, tens of thousands of Armenians fell victim to pogroms, state-supported violence designed to keep them in their place. In 1895, 200,000 had been killed protesting against high taxes and demanding equal rights. Then, in 1908, revolution erupts in Turkey. Officers and liberals in exile, called Young Turks by Europeans, seize power, again promising freedom and equality for all minorities. In reality, they had a very different agenda.
With the success of the Young Turks in 1908, a new idea came to the predatory minority that ruled and robbed Turkey. It was Turkey for the Turks. It was not the result of religious fanaticism, although it brought into play the fanatical passions of the masses. But on the part of the government, it was largely for the spoils and the power.
The new party calls itself the Committee of Union and Progress. The old Sultan is overthrown and his brother installed as the head of what is now a constitutional monarchy. The Young Turks plan the creation of a new racially pure empire, claiming they want to free the Muslim world from the dominance of the infidel. The once mighty Ottoman Empire is severely weakened by the loss of Christian territories in the Balkan War of 1912, a humiliation they also blame on Christians living in their own country. Power lies with the triumvirate of three high-ranking officials called Pasha in Turkish: Enver Pasha as war minister, Cemal Pasha as minister of the navy, and last but not least, the all-powerful Minister of the Interior, later to become head of government, Talat Pasha.
He came from a very humble background. He began as a postman and mail courier on the route to Adrianople. Then he worked as a telegraph assistant and in other departments at the post office. He had astonishing energy and intelligence. Even so, his great intellectual capabilities didn't stop him from harboring the most narrow-minded, chauvinistic delusions. It was as if he was poisoned with a kind of racist fanaticism.
My impression then and now, Talat Pasha was the absolute dictator of Turkey. I had two interviews with him. Talat Pasha looked strong and powerful. He was like a great American political boss, only if he would have been an American boss, he would be the king of bosses. He was a born master executive. After seeing the leading men of the Central Powers, I should say that Talat Pasha was the strongest man between Berlin and hell.
1914 and the First World War. The Russians advance from the east to the west. England starts an offensive on the Dardanelles Strait. Turkey feels threatened by a Christian Europe, except for the German Empire. Turkey now fights at its side.
The German, the Turk, and the devil made a triple alliance.
At a state reception in Constantinople, the German Kaiser greets Turkish officials. To his right stands War Minister Enver Pasha. In the race for influence in the Middle East, Germany seeks an alliance with the Ottoman Empire. They offer to modernize the Turkish army and help restore the country to its former glory. The fate of Armenians is not an issue for the Germans. Economic and military interests do not permit any conflict with their new ally.
First of all, Germany's conduct was extremely cowardly. We had the Turkish government in our hands, from a military, a financial, and even a political point of view. If we had only wanted to, we could have insisted on observance of the most basic principles of humanity. Enver Pasha, and to a greater extent Talat Pasha, the Minister of the Interior and actual dictator of Turkey, didn't really have any other choice but to obey the terms Germany set. They would have obeyed any directive from Germany regarding the Armenian issue.
The Ottoman government felt that with Germany as its ally, it need have no fear of any future retaliations for its plan of complete extermination, as it was convinced that Germany would win the war and would shield Turkey from the vengeance of the Western powers and of Russia. And so the crime was worked out systematically.
In the winter of 1914, the Russian army advances into the Turkish-Armenian districts. Soldiers of Armenian origin fight on both sides. Enver Pasha himself is in command of the counteroffensive in the Caucasus region. But his campaign ends in crushing defeat. 90,000 Turkish soldiers die within a few weeks. The Young Turks government places the blame on a Russian-Armenian conspiracy on fraternization among Christians. It was their only explanation for the fiasco and an opportunity to denounce all Armenians as enemies.
There is no doubt that they used the war for this, because the hostile great powers no longer had any influence on Turkish soil. And in any case, apart from America, they were fully occupied with the war. So there was no time, no one found the time, to concern themselves with the Armenian issue.
The Young Turks spread rumors that their Armenian soldiers had defected to the Russian side, a fabrication built on treason with tragic consequences. Thousands of Armenian soldiers are arrested, tortured, and killed as a direct result.
Only by using tricks such as that were they able to carry out their systematic extermination of the Armenian people. The Turkish government skillfully manipulated public opinion worldwide and then they arranged local conspiracies.
The governor of the city of Van, a brother-in-law of Enver Pasha, prepared an attack on the town's Armenian district. The Armenians barricaded themselves in their neighborhoods to protect their families against the impending massacre. They had no connection with Russia whatsoever. For 4 weeks, they held out against Turkish troops, who laid siege to them and fired upon them.
Under cover of the turmoil of the fighting between Turkey and Russia, Turkish troops attacked the Armenian population in Van, supposedly to crush an uprising. There, the Armenians put up a bitter resistance. Many thousands die. The fighting only stops when Russian troops force the Turks to retreat. As the Russians march into Van, for the Turks, this is yet more proof of a Russian-Armenian conspiracy.
It was used as a pretext to slaughter, for every guilty one, 10,000 innocent people, to assault women and children in the most brutal fashion.
While Turkey's ally Germany deemed an objection to be inappropriate.
It begins with expulsions, supposedly to secure the border with Russia. The authorities claim the Armenians would be settled in Syria, then a part of the Ottoman Empire. A lie. The first Armenian families are sent off on a march to certain death.
But the Turkish government intended to get rid of all Armenians. Of course, they could hardly use the pretext of a wartime evacuation for the entire population. Those people lived hundreds hundreds of miles away from the Eastern Front and the Dardanelles. So a different reason had to be found. Suddenly and miraculously, the government discovered a universal conspiracy amongst Armenians throughout the empire.
The authorities whip up passions amongst the Turks. They claim the only way to avoid military defeat is to eliminate the Armenian threat throughout the country. A new deportation act, carefully refraining from naming the Armenians explicitly, retrospectively justifies the measures taken so far and instructs the army to, as they claim, resettle the populations of any towns and villages suspected of committing acts of treason or espionage.
Once holy war was declared, we could all see where it would lead. They made inflammatory speeches stating, since we're at war with Christians, we need to wipe them out in this country first. Besides, the Turks expected the Russian troops would advance at least as far as Mush. But, as they put it, before that happens, we'll slaughter the Armenians first.
The arrests in Constantinople began on the 24th and 25th of April. 850 people, Orthodox Christians, Protestants and Catholics, were deported. Among them were 10 bishops, 40 doctors and 10 lawyers, also many middle or working class. There were very few Turks with whom you could speak frankly about the Armenian issue. Even otherwise quite sophisticated and cultured people would fly into a rage. They saw all Armenians as the same, tarred with the same brush, constantly repeating, the Armenians must be wiped out. They're all traitors.
And what did the Turkish government have to say about this? I quote, the Ottoman government extends its benevolent protection to all honest and peace-loving Christians living in Turkey. I couldn't believe my eyes when I saw that statement, and I still can't find words to describe the utter hypocrisy of it. The Turkish government is responsible for everything that has happened. It's no use their denying it. They were the ones who deliberately drove the Armenians into this chaos.
The police fell upon them just as the eruption of Vesuvius fell upon Pompeii. Women were taken from the washtubs. Children were snatched out of bed. The bread was left half-baked in the oven. The family meal was abandoned, partly eaten. Children were taken from the schoolroom, leaving their books open at the daily task. And the men were forced to abandon their plows in the fields and their cattle on the mountainside. These people were torn from their homes, almost without warning.
The Armenian men who were arrested were put in stocks. Their feet were shod with nails like horses. Beards, eyelashes, fingernails, and teeth were torn out. They were strung up by the feet, and similar things. Of course, many of them died, but missionaries were able to treat some, which is how we got to see these injuries.
For several days, there were rumors of this, but it seemed incredible. On Saturday, June 28th, 1915, it was publicly announced that all Armenians were to leave after 5 days. Full meaning of such an order can scarcely be imagined by those who are not familiar with the particular conditions of this isolated region. A massacre, however horrible the word may sound, would have been humane in comparison with it. In a massacre, many escape, but a wholesale deportation of this kind in this country meant a lingering and perhaps even more dreadful death for nearly everyone.
When the town crier announced the deportation of the Armenians, Turkish police came and ordered men on this side, women on the other. They herded us like sheep. They drove us out of our houses and off our land.
Many Muslims, Turks and Arabs, shook their heads in disapproval, unable to hide their tears. They couldn't believe that their own government could have ordered these atrocities.
All the Armenian houses in Trebizond had been emptied and the people sent off. There was no inquiry as to who were guilty or innocent of any movement against the government. If a person was an Armenian, that was sufficient reason for being treated as a criminal and deported.
On the 24th of May, 1915, England, France and Russia declare the events in the Ottoman Empire a crime against humanity. The first time this term had ever been used. At this point, America is still neutral and therefore not at war with Turkey. Their ambassador meets with Talat Pasha to protest against his government's brutal actions.
After the exchanging of compliments, we settled down to the business in hand. I've asked you to come today, began Talat Pasha, so that I can explain our position on the whole Armenian subject. We base our objections to the Armenians on three distinct grounds. In the first place, they have enriched themselves at the expense of the Turks. In the second place, they are determined to domineer over us and to establish a separate state. In the third place, they have openly encouraged our enemies. They have assisted the Russians in the Caucasus, and our failure there is largely explained by their actions. We have therefore come to the irrevocable decision that we shall make them powerless before this war is ended.
This was no less than the deportation of the entire Armenian population. Not only from this province, but I understood from all six provinces comprising Armenia, an undertaking greater probably than anything of the kind in all history.
With a map of Anatolia in his hand, one of Talat Pasha's closest aides confirmed to me the Turkish government had decided to step up the deportation of the Armenians even further. Now Armenians in the provinces of Yanik, Trabzon, Zivas, and Mamuretul Aziz would also be deported to Mesopotamia. This could no longer be justified on any military grounds. As Talat Pasha himself confirmed to me, its purpose was to wipe out the Armenians.
Suppose a few Armenians did betray you, I said to Talat Pasha. Is that a reason for destroying a whole race? Is that an excuse for making innocent women and children suffer? Those things are inevitable, he replied.
The weeping and wailing of the women and children was most heartrending. The German consul told me that he did not believe the Armenians would be permitted to return to Trebizond even after the end of the war.
It wasn't easy for the young Turks, who decided to deport and exterminate the Armenians, to annihilate a people in the millions. The deportations went on for a whole year.
It is impossible for me to give any adequate idea of the panic in this locality that has resulted from the announcement of this order of expulsion. Everyone who was obliged to leave was trying to get together a little money to take on the journey. The Turks, of course, were taking advantage of this situation to get things at practically nothing. Robbery and looting were never undertaken in a more wholesale manner. Turkish men and Turkish women were entering the houses of all the Armenians and taking things at almost any price. The scene reminded me of vultures swooping down on their prey. All felt that they were going to certain death, and they certainly had good reason to feel that way.
The furniture, bedding, and everything of value was being stored in large buildings about the city. There was no attempt at classification, and the idea of keeping the property in bales under the protection of the government to be returned to the owners on their return was simply ridiculous. The goods were piled in without any attempt at labeling or systematic storage.
As a matter of fact, the Turks never had the slightest idea of settling the Armenians in this new country. They knew that the great majority would never reach their destination, and that those who did would die of thirst and starvation. The real purpose of the deportation was robbery and destruction.
Constantinople ensured the destruction of the Armenians by ordering regional governors, mayors, and local officials to annihilate. Those civil servants who disobeyed were dismissed. Anyone else who expressed disapproval, officials, the military, the public, was terrorized.
Not just one, but a number of officials are reported to have been executed because they weren't ruthless enough with the Armenians in their districts.
We asked permission for two or three of the missionaries to go with them. This was refused. We were allowed to buy things from them, but not to store things. They were told they were to go to Urfa. Then we began to buy their things and give money to the poor, making knapsacks and filling them with bread and handing them out. At first we wept till it seemed that for the rest of our lives we could never do anything again but weep. Then the true horror of it began to weigh down on us, and then we found it impossible to weep.
The crime that was committed here was so immense that even during the war, its echo was heard everywhere, except in Germany.
Berlin knows perfectly well what has been going on, but neither Jamal Pasha nor any other member of the government see any reason to justify their actions to their German ally. And Germany tacitly accepts their ally's crimes, all in the national interest.
We Germans, soldiers and civilians alike, were outraged. It was incomprehensible. Instead of disassociating itself from the Turks through its silence, the German government has turned us into accomplices. It is with good reason that both our enemies and neutral nations have accused us of condoning these crimes by remaining silent.
What the Turks did was actually our work. It was our officers, our guns, our money. Without our help, the puffed-up frog would have collapsed in a heap. We didn't need to be so gentle with them. To succeed in the Armenian issue, all we had to do was to instill in the Turkish government a fear of the consequences. Our admonishments achieved nothing. It just annoyed them.
I warned at the time, if for military reasons we can't be firm with them, then we'll have no other option than to look on as our ally continues to massacre.
In my opinion, reprimanding an ally in public during an ongoing war, as proposed by Ambassador Metternich, would have been absolutely unprecedented. Our sole objective was to keep Turkey on our side until the end of the war, regardless of whether Armenians perish or not. It was clear to me that we would need the Turks if the war carried on much longer. I didn't understand how Metternich could even make such a suggestion.
We walked for 110 days, almost without a break. The old and the sick, who could walk no more, were abandoned on the side of the road or killed by the police. They drove us onwards. We were hungry. They didn't even let us have anything to drink.
At first, the Armenians from eastern Anatolia are marched to the city of Urfa. Armenians from Constantinople and western Turkey are sent towards Aleppo. Then from these two cities they are forced to walk into the Syrian desert near Deir Zor or out into the steppes of Mesopotamia. In reality, the alleged resettlement is a death march to nowhere.
The state of the deported people defied description. They went out in droves and ate grass from the fields. If they came across a dead camel or some other beast, they fell upon it and fought over it as if it were a treasure.
The Turkish government deliberately set about the destruction of as much of the Armenian population as possible, using methods borrowed from antiquity. Such methods, however, did not become a government that wished to be allied with Germany.
The work was not just done by bands of Kurds, but has for the most part been that of the police who accompanied the people from here, or by companies of armed convicts who have been released from prison for the sole purpose of murdering the Armenian exiles.
Kurds and bandits attacked us, robbed everything we had, and kidnapped girls and young women. I remember that my mother-in-law was pregnant. They murdered her. They rammed a sword into her belly, pulled the baby out, and then began to laugh because it was a boy. They threw him down on the ground. I'll never get those images out of my head.
The route leads the deportees across steppes and mountains alongside the banks of the river Euphrates. Few German soldiers venture to rescue Armenians from their inevitable fate. Faced with their allies' absurd explanations, they're powerless to act.
When the Turks killed the men on the marches, they used the excuse that they had to protect themselves against rebellions. When women and children were raped and kidnapped, then the Turks used the excuse that they didn't have a grip on the Kurds and the police. When they let the deportees starve, then they used the excuse that the difficulties in supplying food on the march were so great that they were unable to overcome them.
My mother and brother were very sick. We simply left them under a tree along the way. It didn't matter anymore. Sooner or later they would have died anyway. Then a different kind of chaos began. They took the young girls. Many of them fled and tried to hide. Eventually I just collapsed somewhere all alone. I saw many girls this had happened to, who then drowned themselves in the river Euphrates. I didn't do that. By then the sun was setting and I was still lying there on the ground. But I thought to myself, soon it will be night and then wolves will come and tear me apart. So I got back up on my feet again and marched on.
Out there, the men were killed, the girls carried away, and the women robbed and left. We didn't know what was still to come.
The persecution of Armenians in the eastern provinces entered its final phase in July 1916. Nothing could deter the Turkish government from its program. Neither our own petitions, nor appeals from the American embassy and the papal delegate. Not even threats from the Triple Entente powers, and least of all any consideration for public opinion in the West.
There are cattle cars on the Baghdad Railway for transporting goats and sheep. They are split into two decks so that animals can be loaded top and bottom. The deportees were loaded into these cars like animals. It was impossible to stand up. They could only kind of crouch, and hardly even that because the cars were so overloaded. Men, women, children, the healthy and the sick were bundled in together and transported for days.
The railway from Constantinople to Baghdad had been built under German planning and supervision. For around 100,000 Armenians from the western Anatolian region near Bursa and Izmit, the Baghdad Railway becomes a journey to certain death. They have to pay for their tickets.
Every day, thousands were transported by train. The sick and dying were loaded on with the rest. When they died, they were simply offloaded at the next station. Bodies were even found thrown down the railway embankments between the stations.
Even more horrifying accounts were given by railway engineers after they returned home. Near Tel Abiyad and Razulayn, they found piles of defiled, naked women's bodies lying on the railway embankment. Many had clubs, forced into their anuses.
The director of operations for the Baghdad Railway, a native Swiss, told me he'd seen many things in his life, things that had hardened him, but he never imagined something like this was possible. You can see why General Pasha had issued a strict ban on photographing the deportees. The ban made the photographing of Armenians as prohibited as taking unauthorized photographs in a battle zone.
Nevertheless, some German soldiers did manage to capture the Armenians' plight on film and smuggled the photos out of the country. Their pictures are a precise record and shocking proof of the first systematic genocide of the 20th century.
The worst thing was to see the horde of orphan children grow day by day. On the perimeter of a tent town, hollows had been dug in the ground for them, covered by old rags. They sat beneath them, head to head, boys and girls of all ages, neglected like animals, starved without food, without bread, huddled together, shivering in the cold of the night, and no one to offer them even the most meager help or comfort. Eyes sunken from their suffering, a look of bitter reproach against the world on their faces.
The German consul from Mosul, Mr. Holstein, reported that on some segments of the route from Mosul to Aleppo, he had seen so many chopped off children's hands that one could have paved the road with them. Numerous reports from the German consulates in Aleppo and Mosul document far worse examples than the few I offer here.
The last refuge for the Armenians are the children's homes, hospitals, and orphanages run by Western missionaries. Doctors and nurses battle to save at least the children. They soon realize that rescuing them is the only way for the Armenian race to survive.
At this point, mention must be made of the actions taken by the Turkish government against the orphanages, hospitals, and schools, maintained by German and American associations for the benefit of the Armenian people. Every day, the authorities threatened the few institutions that had not yet been closed down with the deportation of their Armenian staff, school children and orphans, as well as other measures.
The Turkish government's intentions were revealed by their systematic blocking of any form of relief aid offered by missions, nuns and Europeans living in the country. An offer made by the American government to take deportees to the USA aboard American ships at America's expense was flatly rejected.
At that time, with just a brief curt order, the Turkish government took nearly 1,000 children from my care. The last I saw of them was when they were carried off by that special train, and with that, a veil of darkness was drawn over them and me.
Of those who had lived in our home, almost all have been beaten or starved to death or have disappeared. Only 6 survived, 3 finding their way back. As for the others, I have received very little news. Crippled Mariam Badcha starved to death. Blind little Livon, too. Khatun, also blind, is said to have been drowned in Lake Gulchik. Lake Gulchik is a mountain lake near Mezeri in which thousands of Armenians were drowned.
I spoke forcefully to both Enver Pasha and Jamal Pasha about the Armenian atrocity. But citing wartime necessities, they said that insurgents must be punished, ignoring the fact that hundreds of thousands of women, children and old people were being killed.
The Turkish government did damage both to us as their ally and to themselves. The only route they had for a campaign against Egypt was blocked by tens of thousands of deportees and contaminated with disease. Yet at any moment, they could have needed the road for troop movements.
In the midst of the First World War, strategic military considerations vital to the war effort are ignored by the Turkish government again and again. The deportation is its top priority. Thousands are killed along the way. Those who survive the journey eventually reach the town of Urfa, where they are herded together in a camp. There, they await their fate.
For hundreds of thousands, Urfa had become the transit point on their way to the steppes of Mesopotamia. Conditions aboard the trains grew sadder and ever more wretched. There were no more men among the deportees. The trains contained only women and children between the ages of 4 and 12. They had numbered thousands when they set off together, but only small groups made it to Urfa. Once when I appeared at the deportees' camp with bread, the women called out to me, "What is the use of bread? Why bring us bread? The only thing that awaits us is death. Bring us poison so that we can die here. Please don't let us be taken away. You know what awaits us when we reach the steppes.
and the mothers with their babies. Their breasts had long since gone dry. No other food existed. Few mothers found the courage to drown their children in the river to release them from their suffering. Instead, they were laid in the yard, row upon row. There they cried for as long as they could. When the crying stopped, they gasped for air a few more times until death released them.
It is an avenue of death that stretched from Ofa's walls far, far out onto the scorched yellow plains. That avenue was well planted, but it wasn't shaded by lush green trees. Corpses lined the path, bodies in every stage of decomposition. Some had died right outside the city gates. Beaten from their sick beds by blows from truncheons, they managed to drag themselves on for a few hundred meters. Then they collapsed, and no torture in the world could have made them get back up again. They gasped their last breath and were freed from their suffering.
It was almost impossible to bear. We came across several groups of Armenian women and children. It was a dreadful sight. The policemen who accompanied them told us frankly what they did to these poor people en route. When we asked, where are they headed? They said, if no one else gets them, or they don't die, we'll just have to kill them ourselves.
For those who don't die of hunger or thirst and aren't beaten to death during one of the countless attacks, their journey to death finally ends on the steppes of Mesopotamia or in the Syrian desert near Deir Zor.
In Deir Zor, a small town on the Euphrates, a large concentration camp had been set up for Armenians from all over Turkey. When I was there, there were only around 60,000 people left, mostly walking skeletons. Famine had distorted their features. Their faces looked barely human.
At the entrance to the camp I visited at that time, there was a pile of unburied bodies right next to people's tents. Everyone was suffering from severe diarrhea. The filth in and around the tents was beyond description.
The Turkish burial squads worked from morning till night, but they still couldn't cope with all the work. An elderly policeman said that he'd been here for 25 days. He believed the Armenians had got their just deserts because some had worked against the government. Still, he said it would be better if they were just shot, not slowly tortured to death. He could stand it no more and would surely lose his mind if he had to witness this boundless misery any longer.
I once found a stack of human skeletons piled on top of each other in a gorge. White skulls still covered with hair, a pelvis, a child's rib delicately curved like a clasp. At that moment, I was overwhelmed by a dull despair that brought tears to my eyes, as if I would have to extinguish all hope, all the seeds of love that had ever bound me to life.
Similar tragedies were reported from all over Turkey. Wherever desert sands border an inhabited region, hundreds of thousands of dead bodies. I'll read from the notes I made back then. 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a young woman lies on the left side of the road, naked except for brown socks. She lies on her stomach, head buried in her crossed arms. 1:30, to my right, an old man with a white beard in a ditch, naked, lying on his back. 2 steps beyond, a boy, naked on his stomach, left buttock torn away. 2 o'clock, 5 fresh graves. To my right, a man with exposed lower body and bloodied genitals. 3:45, a dying boy, a bloodied skeleton, love about his leg, 10-year-old girl, above 3 long blonde hair. My left, 22 fresh graves, 500 tents. A man, body of a body girl, a woman clutching a baby, lies in the middle of the road, both dead, arms and legs. A vulture circles above the sea.
One day, Talat Pasha made what was perhaps the most astonishing request I had ever heard. The New York Life Insurance Company and the Equitable Life of New York had for years done considerable business among the Armenians. I wish, Talat Pasha then said, that you would get the American Life Insurance Companies to send us a complete list of their Armenian policyholders. They are practically all dead now and have left no heirs to collect the money. It, of course, all should go to the state. The government is the beneficiary now. Will you do so? This was almost too much, and I lost my temper. You will get no such list from me, I said, and I got up and left him.
In 1918, victorious Allied forces march into Constantinople. Turkey, along with Germany, has lost the war. The Young Turks are removed from power, and the parliament they had suppressed charges those responsible for the genocide. In 1919, Turkish courts sentence the main perpetrators to death in absentia. Enver Pasha, Cemal Pasha, and head of government Talat Pasha, with Germany's assistance, had been able to escape on a German warship. Talat Pasha flees to Berlin, where, under an assumed name,
He and his wife lead a secluded but comfortable life. As for the crimes committed by their loyal ally, Germany remains silent. But on the 15th of March, 1921, Talat Pasha is shot dead in the middle of Berlin. The assassin is caught at once. He states that although he did kill a man, he is not a murderer. The assassination makes headlines around the world, but it would be decades before the perpetrator is revealed as a member of an Armenian group seeking revenge. The deed brought Germany's attention to the genocide for the first time. A single shot fired by the young assassin, Solomon Talerian.
The pistol shot fired by Talerian, an unknown Armenian student, and the trial that followed once again drew the eyes of the world, and for the first time those of the German people too, to the bloodiest chapter of the war. The truth was out. The systematic annihilation of the Armenian people by the Young Turks.
The trial takes place at the Tiergarten Municipal Court in Berlin. German diplomats are prohibited from testifying. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs doesn't want the trial to focus on the genocide or Germany's role in the atrocities. After just 3 days, Talerian is acquitted.
The impact of the events discussed during Talerian's trial was so devastating that despite the obviously violent killing, the jury found him not guilty. Despite all the efforts to keep this trial non-political, the verdict reverberated around the world and obtained historical significance.
Without saying so directly, the jury had acknowledged that the destruction of an entire people could not go unpunished. As a young student in Poland, Raphael Lemkin had been following the trial. It would lead him to draw up the United Nations Convention on Genocide.
Talerian had appointed himself as the executioner of the conscience of mankind. Can anybody appoint himself to carry out justice? At this moment, the murder perpetrated upon an innocent people held a greater significance for me. I still had no definitive answers, but the certain feeling that the world had to promulgate a law against this form of racially or religiously motivated murder. Sovereignty cannot be misunderstood as the right to kill millions of innocent human beings.
It would take another 30 years before Lemkin's ideas become reality. But in 1920, at the peace conference in France, the Armenians are promised that those responsible for the genocide would face international condemnation. But 3 years later, Kemal Atatürk, the new head of the Turkish government, is once again seen as a key ally of the West. Strategic issues take precedence. Atatürk demands a high price for this new alliance. His opposition to any prosecutions or an independent Armenian state in Anatolia is conceded. In addition, he refuses to allow the surviving Armenians to return to their old homes.
Attempts to get the new Turkish government to allow the refugees to return to their Anatolian homeland were futile. The Turks hid behind the pretext that the refugees' return constituted a danger to the Turkish army.
The survivors of the genocide are a few women, but above all, children. They are kept either as house slaves or forced into harems. Defenseless, they are subjected to repeated abuse. Tirelessly, missionaries attempt to save those they could.
It was enough to make you lose all hope. How are these remnants of the Armenian people supposed to cope? And the many, many fatherless children, they simply overwhelmed them. We were sick with worry for them.
After the war, my wife and I were able to bring 8,000 children to Lebanon. From Harput, 5,000 children had to be shipped out, so each group had to be as large as possible. During the 3 months of the transports, I twice managed to send around 700 children on their way at a time. Those were great days. How the children's faces beamed as they set off on their journey. Surely the Israelites couldn't have been happier when they left Egypt.
It is thanks to people like Jakob Künzler that up to 500,000 Armenians survived the Young Turks genocide. The survivors, all now over 100 years old, find new homes in places such as Lebanon, France, and the USA, or the Caucasus, where a new, tiny Armenian Republic is founded. In Turkey itself, only about 60,000 Armenians remain, and of those, only a few acknowledge their origins. Rant Dink, the murdered journalist, had tried, with little success, to start a long-overdue debate. It cost him his life. But his death sparked a wave of protest. 200,000 Turks took to the streets in one of the biggest demonstrations ever seen in Turkey, in solidarity with Rant Dink, the Armenians, and the longing for truth.
It was very unusual that in this country, having denied many things in the past, that such a campaign could take place. I believe that Turkey, because of its record, because of its history, should be ready, should be bold enough to say, I'm sorry for what has happened.
Nobody could imagine that in Turkey, that many people would go on the streets and would say, we're all Hrant Dink, we're all Armenians. there is this public who are really raising their voice, and the state has to hear it at some point, and I think they're hearing it.
I want all of you to never forget, this is what a totalitarian government does to their opposition, or their perceived opposition. Once a government takes full control of you, any of you that are seemed to be a threat to them, any of you that are perceived to be a threat, they will kill you. Every country that's had a genocide in it, one of the most famous statements ever made by all of their citizens is, well, that'll never happen in my country. What else will never happen in your country? The government would never come in and order everyone to stop working, would they? We're getting set up for that here in this country. You can see it and I can see it. The communists that parade themselves around and call themselves Democrats are the evil that has destroyed every nation on earth from the inception of civilization. They've called themselves different things all the time. Now they're Democrats, but they're not. They're communists, full blown. They want to take our firearms away. They want to take away our ability to defend ourselves. And they want to instill in us our willingness to be controlled and our willingness to allow them to do whatever they want to us. This is how sheep are trained, and we've been trained for 120 years since the beginning of the public school system and the collusion with communism all over the world, working to destroy America and what America has stood for. Now, I'm leaving now, but there's going to be a gentleman speak here that says what needs to be said a lot clearer than I can.
What does it mean to be a nation? It's a question we have to ask ourselves in a moment when so many people seem open to the possibility of a national divorce. A nation isn't just a random group of people who happen to be in the same place at the same time. It has laws and borders and values, and it isn't born, it is made. The people who made America in the first place were a group of a little more than 2,000 patriots who crossed an icy Delaware River on Christmas night in 1776. They were down to the end, ravaged by a hard winter, deserted by friends, looking like just one more pathetic colonial rebellion put down by the mightiest empire in the world. And then Thomas Paine published The American Crisis. You'll recognize the opening words. These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of his country. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. Within a day, George Washington had the message read aloud to his troops. Within a week, they embarked on one of the most daring raids in military history. And what they did changed the world. I come to you now in the midst of another American crisis, one where we cannot afford to tolerate summer soldiers and sunshine patriots. They like to call themselves happy warriors, but so often the only wars they want to fight are for lower capital gains taxes, tech deregulation, and of course, paying for all those pricey ones overseas. As for the wars here at home, the ones that matter over the very culture of the nation, when it comes to those, they fade away. They'll leave those to you, the people. The crisis we face today goes to the heart of what kind of nation we will be. As in 1776, it is a question of who rules. Is it the globalist tech oligarchs, Hollywood executives beholden to China, the race radicals who dominate our universities, a fundamentally anti-American media, the frail, feeble politicians, and the Marxist children of the left? Or is it us, the American people, a great people, a free people, who above all care not for money or power, but for the nation we love? In 1842, an aged veteran of the American Revolution named Levi Preston was asked why he fought. Was it the Stamp Act, the tax on tea, the philosophical principles? He replied, "Young man, what we meant in going for those redcoats was this. We always had governed ourselves, and we always meant to. They didn't mean we should." The same challenge faces us today. The forces arrayed against the survival of the United States of America, foreign and domestic, do not believe you have the capacity, the ability, or the right to govern yourselves. They work every day to scare you into silence, indoctrinate your children, gaslight you with falsehoods, direct your future, and stamp out your freedom. Understand, it is the totalitarian left that wants a national divorce. They want racial strife that burns down your cities. They want envy and segregation and division that pays for their million-dollar homes in Topanga Canyon. They want to demolish Mount Rushmore, make you pay for abortions, and force your daughters to compete in sports against men. They want to teach your children to hate cops, the anthem, the flag, and everything you were raised to love and respect. They want to destroy our great American experiment, a thriving, capitalist, multi-ethnic republic of God-fearing people for all time. But we're on to them. We're not going to let them. And together, we're going to show them what free people do.